Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. Today we're going to have a program where we talk about something that chemists hold very dear to themselves and physicists look at with a totally different attitude, and that is the periodic table. Everybody has seen a periodic table, but this particular physicist that we're going to be talking to has got a new idea. He wants to make it a three-dimensional periodic table. So we're going to be talking today, that's Russ Chianelli, my co-host, and myself, to Professor Shiv Khanna from the Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. And Shiv, welcome to Science Studio.
Great to be here. How did a physicist like you get involved in the fields that we're going to be talking about later, when you were younger?
Well, the two subjects that fascinated me from my high school were chemistry and physics. And the idea of the things we see around us and how do they work, what's there inside. And, you know, in India, we do not have as much of the facilities as we have here. Just to give you an example, one of the things which fascinated me was electromagnets. How does, we can take an iron rod, wrap a wire around, it becomes a magnet. Well, I did not have too much of the wire, and I did have an old iron rod, so I wrapped the wire around. And in India, the voltage is 210 volts or 220 volts, and just connected it, having the main switch off, and had the main switch on. Of course, the fuse goes out, everything, this thing, but at least it became magnetic and it attracted the things. So the fascination of seeing things around you and then understanding how the things work and so on. By the time I got to college, the inclination was more towards physics, and therefore I decided to have this BSc in physics, but keeping my interest in chemistry all along. Now, you realize the field we are working now, which is nanoscience or clusters, is an interdisciplinary area which overlaps physics, chemistry, material science, biology. So in some sense, that interest has come back in terms of this joint effort.
Let me ask you a question. You said in high school you were interested in building an electromagnet and so on. But if you go back earlier, you must have had interests of science even younger.
Yes. Yes, it did. It did. But the electromagnetic story was even before high school. It was when you know, I was in middle school or so, and you learn that you can make a magnet by wrapping a wire around. You read, and you don't know whether it really works or not, and we don't have a magnet
around. It was just a teacher that told you.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And then you want to try everything. So that's how the whole thing became. But also during my university years, I was blessed with lot of professors, many of them came back from America, returned there, were excellent professors who inspired, in some sense, creativity, not just this ordinary teaching style, but forcing that and working with them, talking with them, and the interest grew more in terms of science.
So, I mean, you started out by doing the experiment, yes, fusing all the lights.
That's
for
right.
Your home and maybe some other homes too, for all
that's
I know.
Right.
And so that was the experimental part of you. So maybe that drove you later on to be more of a theoretically inclined person, right? So these experiments can be dangerous. Let's just try and find out what's going on by doing some theory, right?
Yes, but if you look from another point of view, even the theory I do today, all the theoretical work we do, we collaborate extensively with experimentalists. So this idea of not only theorizing something but having an experimental justification and basis has in some sense existed all along, and it's continuing.
I agree with you. So what you're saying basically is the best theory goes with good experiments.
Absolutely.
To prove the theory.
Absolutely. Just doing pure theory without any experiment is science fiction. You know, you can theorize things and so on, but the experimentalists in some sense keep the reality in terms of what we are developing. And all the theory I'm doing now has experimental counterparts from different places and so on.
Before we get into the detail, just finish the story. So all of your education was in the Indian subcontinent, or
yes,
have you moved around since, or did you come straight here?
No. I did my PhD from University of Delhi in India. Mm-hmm. Then I did my postdoc in CNRS Grenoble in France. It's a wonderful place. They have European centers there, French research center, and so on. And that was a place to meet a lot of exciting people. They had several Nobel laureates which were on the thing, and everybody used to have lunch together. It was a nice opportunity to meet these scientists. And then after Grenoble, I moved to Switzerland, École Polytechnique Federal in Lausanne, Switzerland. I was there for 3.5 years, came to Northeastern in Boston for a year, and then finally came to Richmond, Virginia.
So a typical peripatetic academic. Academic exactly. Gypsies, I think, yes. some people call us.
Well, I would have loved to stay in Boston, but my wife felt it was too cold, and then we're not used to.
Okay. So let's get right into it then. I mean, let's go back to the beginning where you've got this recent concept that you've been able to put into the literature of a three-dimensional periodic table. Why don't you sort of give us a sort of a simple idea of what you imagine is a three-dimensional periodic table?
Maybe I can start with briefly about nanoscience.
Yeah, lovely.
And then go over to this idea of super atoms and so on. Extensive work over the last 30 years or so, mostly experimental and theoretical all combined, has shown that if you reduce the matter to small scales, scales where we have only a couple of atoms, say about 10 to about few thousand atoms, the properties can change dramatically from the bulk, and not only they can change, new properties can evolve, and the properties depends on the size, etc. Let me give an example. Gold is a noble metal. It doesn't corrode. It doesn't rust. You know, we have these gold bands which we exchange during the marriages. And sometimes the band lasts more than the marriage. And, you know, it doesn't rust. And yet we find that if you break the gold into very small pieces, pieces containing maybe about 30, 40 or about 100 atoms or so, it becomes a very strong catalyst. It can catalyze carbon monoxide to carbon dioxide. There's a company which is using these gold particles, what they call odor killers. So something which is completely inert in the bulk phase can become a very strong catalyst. Aluminum is another example. It's the third most abundant element on Earth. And all aluminum in nature is coated with this oxide layer. Small aluminum particles are used by air force in propellants and in other high energetic materials. And all these particles are covered with oxide, so all that material is wasted. And we find that if we break these aluminum to very small particles containing 13 atoms or so, these particles, when negatively charged, will not react with oxygen at all. So a complete change in behavior from the solid to this small size. Take the case of magnetism. There are 9 ferromagnetic metals of the periodic table, and the question we asked was, are there elements which are non-magnetic in the solid state but will become magnetic as you break them to small pieces? And we predicted rhodium, for example. It's a very important catalyst, but it's non-magnetic. You break it into very small pieces and they become magnetic. The point being that in small sizes, new behaviors, new properties emerge.
Now tell me, was that a theoretical discussion first, or did you know that there were rhodium magnetic particles when you get to a certain size? Which came first?
Yeah, the theory came first.
In fact, this is a case where the theory led the experimentalists.
Absolutely. We predicted it, and then experiments were done in University of Virginia, which confirmed this thing, and both papers came one after another.
But I would add to that that ancient history, alchemists in the Middle Ages were using gold colloids of different colors because of their size for medicine. And I even believe the Greeks were using silver for purification of water.
Please. Absolutely, absolutely, yes. And in fact, the colors in the churches where you see these glasses, all these colors, are very fine gold particles because the color changes as you change the size of the gold particles. So you're absolutely right.
How did we figure this out back then when we didn't have machines? And
I think it was more a question of observation. They must have created them and then found that they change color and so on.
And there are these special cups somewhere.
Yeah.
That if you shine lights, they have
different colors. If you shine light from inside or from outside.
Right. There's an example of the cognoscenti knowing something and then sort of trying to pass it off as magic or some divine power and manipulating their knowledge. But we don't do that anymore.
That is right. That's it. Now we understand.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
So then you've got this concept of being able to make predictions about very small aggregates of atoms of metals like 10, 12,
yeah.
100.
Yeah.
And so that leads us into then different properties that they have.
That's
and then
right.
a certain cluster may have a property that's similar to some other element, I guess.
That is right. Now, that brings me to this idea of superatoms. Those are the atoms which extend the periodic table in the third dimension. What you find is that in very small symmetric particles, for example, aluminum 13 clusters, the electronic states are punched into groups, much as we teach our students about atoms. So in an atom, the electron moves in electronic levels, and we have 1s level, 2s level, 2p level, and so on. It so happens that in small clusters also, these electronic states become grouped into these shells. They are different from the atoms, but they are nevertheless the shells. And the chemical properties offered by these clusters depend on the filling or unfilling of the shells much in the same way as in atoms.
So when you're talking about a single atom, the way we teach it, they're very localized orbitals, as we call them.
That right? is right.
And what you're saying is that when you start to get the clusters, now these orbitals are delocalized over the whole cluster.
Absolutely.
With different levels that don't allow you to use the old rules of Hund's rule of maximum multiplicity, one electron going into here, and so on and so forth.
Yes. The only distinction being, as you said, these orbitals become delocalized over the whole cluster, but the shapes are very similar to those in atoms of these orbitals. Now, the fact that they are delocalized, as you said, offers you opportunities which you could not do in atoms, because I can change these shapes by moving the atoms around, which I could not do in a single atom. So that's where this flexibility is coming. So now let us take an aluminum 13 cluster. Aluminum is trivalent, and a 13 cluster has 39 atoms. And if you look at the last electronic level, it's a p level, which needs one electron to fill itself. The situation is very similar to that in a chlorine atom or in a halogen atom. And if you do experimentally, aluminum 13 minus, which is filled shell, experiments indicated that it does not react with oxygen, even though bulk aluminum is highly reactive. What was even more surprising, and that's what I did at that time, that the electron affinity of aluminum 13 was almost the same as that of a chlorine atom. So by collecting 13 aluminum atoms through this quantum grouping of states, I have created something whose electronic properties mimic that of a chlorine atom or the halogen atom. If you take 14 aluminum atoms, they have 42 electrons. The shell filling occurs at 40 electrons, so it wants to donate 2 electrons, and it behaves like an alkaline earth atom.
Like a calcium or something.
Exactly.
So it's fascinating.
Yeah. So, and this is not only theory. We proved it experimentally, where in the group of Wilcoxon at Penn State, with collaboration with them, we created aluminum 13 iodide, added an electron, and the electron resided on aluminum 13. We were even able to make salts with aluminum 13 potassium, much in the same way as you create ionic salts using sodium chloride. And this was verified with the experiment just done at Johns Hopkins. So by using the same atom, by changing size, I'm able to create entities which mimic chemical behaviors of atoms in the periodic table, and thereby this idea that we can extend this periodic table into a third dimension with these entities which I called super atoms.
So the point, though, for the audience and for myself is that, yes, you've mimicked, say, chlorine,
yes,
by your aluminium cluster with a negative charge. But, of course, size is totally different. So you're talking about chemistry here or similarity based upon electron movement, but not necessarily upon structures of materials that you can make.
That's very true. So the materials you will make with these things will have much different arrangements than this thing. This brings me to the two things we learned from nature which you can carry here. Let's go back to carbon atoms. We teach in our elementary courses, Carbon makes graphite. It also makes diamond. It can make buckyballs, probably the Nobel Prize game. These are same carbon atoms, but arranged in different ways. So what nature teaches us, things that are the same atoms arranged differently can lead to different properties. The second thing we learn from nature is sometimes you can take atoms and combine them into building blocks, and the properties of the building blocks are very different from those of atoms. We eat table salt every day. Sodium is highly reactive, chlorine is highly irritating, and yet sodium chloride properties are very different. So creating entities, arranging them in different ways, gives you this new properties.
This is a fascinating set of stories. I'm going to have to incorporate it into classes that I teach. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, here with Russ Chianelli and Shiv Khanna from the Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. We're talking about new ways of looking at the periodic table. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. They're slimy, squiggly, and eat dead tissue. But they're not some creature from a horror movie. I'm talking about maggots.
Maggots, as in the worm-like larvae of flies? Why are we talking about them?
Because they're good medicine. They were approved as a prescription therapy in 2004 and have been used to cleanse wounds for thousands of years.
Surgeons in Napoleon's army noticed soldiers whose wounds were infected with maggots were more likely to survive. During the American Civil War, doctors deliberately put maggots into wounds, letting them consume dead, decaying flesh without affecting healthy tissue. Eventually, maggot therapy fell out of favor when antibiotics came out.
But not so fast. Fly larvae are still used today, and the practice even has a fancy name, biosurgery. Maggots are extremely effective in treating diabetic patients with open sores on legs and feet that have stopped responding to antibiotics. They're also able to consume infected areas that surgeons have trouble seeing and removing.
An average application of sterile maggots can consume 10 to 15 grams of necrotic tissue per day. Anything they consume, including bacteria, is liquefied and destroyed so that healthy cells can move in.
Maggots also change the pH in the wound, and their secretions contain proteases, which are enzymes that degrade proteins in the tissue, including those that cause inflammation.
Much about how maggots work in wound healing remains a mystery and needs further study. What's apparent is archaic therapy is resurging as an effective medical tool, sometimes in cases where antibiotics no longer work.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Professor Shiv Khanna from the Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. And we've been talking about an idea that Professor Khanna has about extending the periodic table by putting clusters of atoms that have properties very similar to an element within the periodic table. And so instead of just having chlorine now, above chlorine we're going to have aluminium 12 minus
aluminium
or something
13.
Like that.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. Two questions immediately. How do you make these molecules, tailor-make them? How do you put together just 12 atoms of this element or 13 of the other? That's not simple.
Yeah, that's where the developments are coming now.
But it's interesting. What you're saying really is something that I agree with completely is that looking at the periodic table from a chemistry point of view is sort of two-dimensional. And they really have to introduce the physics in the third dimension to understand what you're doing, especially if you're going to make small particles. And there is this phenomenon that we study, the exciton confinement, that these, when the particle gets smaller, some of these things are confined, and that's one of the things that changes the properties.
That is true. These electronic states being confined in this region is what leads to these grouping of shells and so on. The question of making these materials, that's where the research is being done and research needs to be needed. We can make them in very small quantities in beams where you can vaporize a metal, pass a gas, and these atoms come together and we can make them. But this is not the way because you cannot make macroscopic quantities using such an approach. So you need synthetic chemical methods. And what you do in these methods is you take salts which contain these metal atoms as precursor, and you create experimental conditions where these salts come together, these atoms come together and make these clusters and so on.
So it's like a fusion process?
It's a process where the chemical reaction goes on and the metal-metal atoms combine and the remaining portions go away or they go out. We have not been able to do this for aluminum, but we have been able to do this process for arsenic just to demonstrate the potential of this thing. So with collaborators from Penn State in the chemistry department, synthetic chemist, we were able to take 7 arsenic atoms and combine. Arsenic 7 needs 3 electrons to become stable, just like aluminum 13 needs 1. So we have put different alkali atoms surrounding them, or we can put some units which mimic the alkali atoms, and we have been able to create solids which are zero-dimensional, where these clusters are all separated from each other. They are one-dimensional, where these clusters are joined by one atom, two-dimensional or three-dimensional.
So and you would be, for example, again for the audience, if you need 3 electrons, you would take 3 sodium atoms.
Yes.
And then the 3 sodium atoms would each give an electron. So you're going to have an Na3 and then arsenic 8 or whatever the number.
You have arsenic 7.
Arsenic 7.
And 3 sodium separated from each other and then linking to other arsenic atoms and so on.
So you could use lanthanides too? I mean, can you play this game in the periodic table rather than 3 from sodiums, which is rather easy to take the electron, can you take 3 electrons from 1 lanthanum?
That's what we are trying to do now. In the sense, can we extend this now to a whole variety of things where we can not only change the building blocks, but the linking units and so on. But to come back to the thing, we were able to demonstrate. We made about 25 or 26 assemblies using arsenic 7 with different thing, and we demonstrated that we can change the band gap all the way from about 0.8 EV to about 2.4 EV or so.
Just tell again the audience, band gap, what do you mean by a band gap?
A band gap is the gap between the highest occupied states and the lowest unoccupied. It's the band gap which determines, for example, which light is absorbed by the given medium.
To excite the electron into a sort of a...
Across the gap,
right,
and you absorb that radiation.
What you're talking about, you could make a very efficient solar cell by making a stretch of band gaps across the solar spectrum.
Exactly. That was my next sentence. I'm glad you said that. That's exactly the point, that I can absorb radiations of those wavelengths by taking these solids and so on. For example, solar radiation, I think the maximum radiation comes around 1.2 EV, around that number. You could create a material with that band gap where you can absorb that radiation. So opportunities of application there. Opportunity of applications in catalyst, because these super atoms, because the states are so delocalized, you can control their catalytic properties by adding ligands or by adding different components. And that offers opportunities for making new catalysts. New magnetic materials, that's another line we are pursuing now. So the dream is to use them as the building blocks and create materials. And because I can control their properties, I can control the properties of the building blocks.
So going back to the synthesis then, you can make clusters of, say, arsenic.
Yeah.
And you've been able to do it also with aluminum or no?
No, not yet with aluminum.
What have you been able to do in terms of catalysis, for example?
Catalysis are only experiments done in beams.
Okay.
Where we generated these clusters in beams, added these iodines, and we can show that catalytic properties can be changed by adding ligands. We have not been able to make catalysts in large amounts to demonstrate that you can use these things in chemistry.
Yeah, I think that's an important point when we talk about chemistry and physics. All of the methods you're using for synthesis are really physical beams and sprays and so on. Not doing something in a beaker.
But the arsenic things was done in the beaker.
Okay.
Where you use the salts, and there you could make them in kilograms. You know, you can, because the nature brings these metal atoms together, and because they are stable, it forms these solids with arsenic 7 with all these alkalis surrounding that.
So the question then comes to the lay person, in this case Russ and I would be lay people, what's so special about arsenic is that in the periodic table, that's called a metalloid. It's one of these beautiful elements like germanium, silicon, that can be metallic under certain conditions and non-metallic. Is that the secret, or is there some other reason for arsenic?
The reason we came here, because arsenic 7-3 minus, we knew from chemistry, is a very stable species. And we just wanted to experiment on this thing because there are ways of bringing these arsenics together in this way. But the experiment continues. I mean, we are going to do with aluminum and with other things.
But let me follow up on that question a little bit. When you're looking at the periodic table, in the first transition metals, you have 3Ds.
Yes.
And then you have the 4 and 5Ds next, and those are quite different than the 3Ds.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, and the magnetic atoms we create, they will mimic the properties of 3D transition metals, iron, cobalt, and nickel. But they will also have their unique features, which are different. And you're absolutely right. 3D, 4D, and 5D elements are very different. Nickel is not as good a catalyst as palladium or platinum. So
because of the 4D electrons.
Because of the 4D electrons, yeah. So we have to now mimic, study what is so important in what makes these as important catalysts, and try to mimic those kind of things in my superatom analogy to create those orbitals which can catalyze reactions much in the same way as they can do here.
So let's go back to an experiment that you have done where you've created these clusters of aluminium and in the beam, and then introduced to them ligands or other molecules that you have seen new chemistry. Can you give us an example?
Yes. For example, with aluminium 13 or aluminium 14, we added iodine ligands.
Right.
And we were able to see in some cases they increased the reactivity. In other cases, the reaction was that of methanol with these things.
Methanol. Okay.
Yeah, that was a test case.
Right.
We just did. So in some cases, it reacted. In other cases, it changed the reactivity. So we demonstrated that by putting these iodine ligands, we can change the catalytic character or the reactive character of the aluminium core.
What were the two reactions that you were seeing that were different?
Yeah, this was a methanol reacting with these things.
To produce what?
I think it was so much not in the sense of they break the whether the methanol is being absorbed there or it is not being absorbed there.
So this is not actually a catalytic process.
No.
But I thought I remember reading somewhere that you've done something with formaldehyde, for example.
Yes.
Again, tell us about that.
These are all reactivity experiments.
Right.
Just if we can bring the carbon-oxygen bonds or carbon
right.
or the oxygen-hydrogen bonds and so on. So it's just reaction with these things, bond-breaking reactions. It's not actually producing product and going to the catalytic cycle, as you are saying. We have not done that stage yet.
Let me just back off a minute, because in that paper that I just read on the internet, you took formaldehyde with an aluminium cluster of eight or something, and then you produced an aluminium cluster of six and with a CH2 associated with it.
Yes.
So you'd remove the oxygen. So that's real chemistry.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely intellectually brilliant. I got to say that, Chip. I just find this absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
Somehow I got to incorporate it into our classes. I teach periodic table. Thank you so much for being here and talking to us about this excitement.
It was a great pleasure talking with you.
Yes,
thank you very much.
It really is very exciting, and this is a new experience for me in the many shows I've done in Science Studio. I want to continue the discussion with you, but I need a non-disclosure agreement. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening out there, and we'll be back next week with another Science Studio, so you be there too. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Donald Moss, a recently retired UTEP psychology professor, has started Brain Tools, a company created to get a new Alzheimer's drug to patients. His treatment has shown to be 3 to 5 times more effective than all other drugs. Read about Moss and his $30 million campaign to get the medicine approved and moved to market. Go to mcasynapse.org, the region's life sciences news digest.